This is Holmes Ralston leading a seminar in the microbiology department, Colorado State University, on the biological conservation of microbes. The date is September the 11th, 1989.
And I wanted to put a question mark after the title, but I was afraid if I did that, nobody would come, because I would reveal my ignorance. And so I just put the title without any question mark. But the title really should have a question mark, because what I'd like to do is spend 40, 50 minutes sort of asking whether there is or ought to be any such thing as the biological conservation of microbes. I do teach a class called Environmental Ethics, and we worry about the conservation of grizzly bears, and we worry about whether you ought to shoot mama bears in the spring, as is going on now with the Colorado Division of Wildlife. We worry about reintroducing a wolf to Yellowstone, or whether Yellowstone should have been left to burn last summer. All of these are kind of big-scale issues, and I guess we don't really say anything at all about microbes in my class. Maybe I'll find out today that we should, or shouldn't. So let's work on it a little bit. You have an Endangered Species Act with a number of amendments passed in 1973, considered one of the world's strongest acts in language, and maybe considered one of the world's most underfunded acts from time to time. So we have in the United States kind of a model endangered species law. But it doesn't cover microbes. It covers big animals, it covers plants, it covers invertebrates of various kinds, but microbes are omitted. So we don't have any legal protection for microbes. And I guess then the question I want to raise is unfine. Does anybody know if there are any laws in this country or any other country that deal with the biological conservation of microbes?
We don't have a lot of smallpox.
It becomes smallpox a little later, but there are no laws. Is there an answer to the first question, that there don't exist any laws about the conservation of?
Is there one in France about the organisms that permit teams?
Good question. Are there laws in France about microbes involved in permanent? Anybody know? Think maybe you've heard of such a law?
Yeah, it seems like a possibility.
The answer seems to be then that there might be such laws, might have to do with microbes. Now, let's ask about the recombinant stuff and the patent and so forth. Are there any laws, I think there might be some laws, that deal with strains or breeds of microbes?
Yes,
You can patent.
Recombinant.
Microbes.
Right.
So there are some laws about maybe what you can patent.
Right.
With regard to microbes.
And there are very weak laws as to what you can do with it in terms of turning it loose.
see, patent would have to do with, you know, what you can own and control and get money on if somebody else knew, that's part of it. But I wouldn't think a patent law as such would deal with what you can turn loose. But there may be additional laws which say what you can and can't turn loose and what the safeguards are. So there will be laws perhaps existing then with regard to microbes have to do with whether you can patent it, with whether you can turn the manufactured stuff loose. No laws have to do with the conservation of microbes. That's okay, so that I think is probably the answer, as far as we've come to answer that. The next question I would like to ask is, are there any endangered microbes?
Well, there's the swamp, if you want to consider viruses, microorganisms, the swamp pox.
Swamp pox comes to mind.
Is endangered.
And I want to have a little discussion about
probably
swamp,
the polio virus.
Swamp pox later. But the swamp pox may be the only case in the world ever of a deliberate extinction. Maybe or maybe not. Let's hold off on smallpox. So then, but we have mentioned smallpox, if the virus is a main one. Smallpox might be one. Polio might be another one. That's, okay. So that's two. If the virus is a microbe, that's two that have been made endangered, perhaps by deliberate human activities. But now, are there any other endangered microbes?
Rubella.
Measles? Is that measles?
Yeah.
Okay, that's three.
Yellow fever virus.
Yellow fever? Does that have a name?
You know what the name of it
is. I said it. So these are all, would all be cases of which the things that we're trying to make extinct because they're disease organisms. Does anybody think of any, are there many cases where microbes, you know, are endangered by condominiums or by dams or by development?
Like loss of habitat.
Loss of habitat. Wild lands. Do you have any, do you think that we just in ignorance about whether that happens or not? Or do we have some reason to believe that it doesn't happen? Just in ignorance? I guess another way of answering that is, asking that question is, there are other things that occur in the world that are endemics, global endemics. So you get this darn toad in Texas that lives where they want to build condominiums, right? Nowhere else on Earth. And you get birds in Hawaii that just live in a very limited local area because they evolved there nowhere else on Earth. And you get the paintbrushes on San Clemente that just local population. Are some microbes endemic to local areas?
Yeah.
Sure. How endemic? Endemic to a county? Endemic to a stream? Endemic? Pretty locally endemic?
Yeah, you have in geothermal habitats, you have thermophilic organisms that predominate.
Such as some endemic. So there are certain sorts of rare habitats that might well contain endemic microbes.
The Great Salt Lake and the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is a misnomer because you have organisms in there.
So the Dead Sea, for example, good. The Great Salt Lake have endemic microbes.
Right.
Microbes.
in our human bodies?
Yeah.
Would I like it to be endemic to what?
Our human bodies.
Well, endemic to humans, but humans are all over the globe. Unless you think that there's some populations of some microbes that are just found in CSU students. Are there populations like that that are endemic to, the microbes in some central or some central Africa? Some microbes are endemic to small human populations. The ones I've heard mentioned, which I think that's a good point, that there's some microbes that might be endemic to unusual environments. Then if that's true, then it might be likely the case that there are a number of microbes that are endemic. Yes.
What about all the strains of something like parvovirus here?
Tell me a little bit about arbovirus. I took the name out. What does it do? I mean, just to identify it. Is it a disease organism?
Yes.
Causes what disease?
One of the diseases would be a respiratory point.
Okay. It causes encephalitis in horses, humans? And various strains of it might be pretty local.
So would you consider it a rare organism that is a strain?
Yeah. Well, let's raise a question at that level. The Endangered Species Act, of course, protects species. But it also protects subspecies, and the definition of species is pretty loose, so it's pretty clear that what they sort of mean is the protection of sort of recognizably different taxa. And that works pretty well at the species level, first off. But it's sometimes the listing of these things goes down to subspecies, so the quail down in Mexico that's protected is really just a subspecies of white, but it looks different. You can easily tell it apart. And there was debate about the Mexican duck, which hybridizes with mallards, and in some places is produced. So there's some debate about species and subspecies, but generally the species level works fairly well for identifying this duck, with some stretching it down to subspecies. Now, my question is, I don't know anything really about the taxonomy of microbes. I have an idea of sort of feeling that the genus-species distinction is used there, but it doesn't work very well there. At what level of protection, what taxonomic level might we be interested? I can imagine you saying, for instance, that all of the microbes are pretty much alike. And therefore, we just need to protect it. at the level of genus, since there aren't any very interesting differences. Then I can imagine you saying just the other extreme, that at microbes, the interesting differences are way down at the strain level. They're important. So where are we? If we did want to protect microbes, would it be at the genus level, species level, family level, phyla level, or strain level, or whatever? Or might we want to make different distinctions depending on whether we're protecting these in the wild or protecting these for medical uses? Right?
Just a question whether the premise is that you want to protect them because you've protected other species.
We haven't got to that much yet, though that's perhaps tied into this. What I'm saying is that with the big stuff, the grizzly bears, and even with the pink pressure, protection at the species level seems to be about where we want to fix the level of protection. For many biologists, the level of species is kind of real. in the sense that species are breeding populations. That's where the reproduction is.
Right.
Whereas genus doesn't reproduce, families don't reproduce. So they're interested in protecting at the level of where they think the reproductive activity takes place in the natural world. And I guess I'm kind of asking whether that's transferred down to the level of microbes at all. If you did want to protect them, what level would protection be biologically sound? Well, if the category of species works at the microbial level, as well as it generally works at the level of vertebrates and bushworms,
you can have interspecies genetic recombination among microorganisms, which you don't have above.
You can have interspecies.
You can have one species.
Jumping genes kinds of stuff.
Well, that's part of it.
Part of it.
But you can have genetic transfer between two different species at the microbial level. And this is rather rare among microorganisms.
Okay, good point. So it may be that there are different kinds of genetic speciating processes occurring in microbes that you want to protect.
Or don't want to protect.
Or don't want to. That are different from the sorts of things that occur genetically in the speciating process between angiosperms and mammals. Now, ask about reasons why we would want to do this if we did decide we wanted to conserve microbes. Now, the usual reason, standard reason given when the Endangered Species Act is advertised and bragged about and urged and so forth, is that all these things in the tropical forest will have possible agricultural or industrial or medical uses. They might very well have these uses. We may not know about these now, but we've discovered from time to time in the past that just lots and lots of plants have medical uses and so forth. So agricultural, industrial, and medical uses are the first line of defense when somebody wants to protect rare plants or something that's a tropical forest. Without all these things in it, we haven't even classified yet, and there's good reason to think there are a number of percentage of those will be useful to us in the future. Now, let's ask that question with regard to microbes. And I think I already know the answer to that. There are many, many microbes that have industrial, medical, and agricultural uses. You agree about that?
Yeah.
Now, are some of these species that are endangered, if there are some, are those species, as opposed to all of those, are they likely to have agriculture, industrial, and medical uses?
Mm-hmm.
Possible who knows. Okay, now the possible who knows argument, that kind of works like junk in the basement, in the sense that, you know, I just got lots of junk in the basement, my wife says throw it out. I say, you know, it's possible it might have a use someday. But after a while, you just run out of basement space. And you have to evaluate the risk probability a little bit, maybe. Yeah. So it's possible, of course, that there may be found some rare species in the Great Salt Lake, which turns out to have dramatic, can brew some kind of medicine out of it that will cure kidney disease. It's possible. But is there any sort of good reason to think that? Any examples of rare microbes that have been passed through use of course with penicillin, but is it the case that the presently existing medicines that are made from microbes are made from extremely common microbes or from ones that were found in unusual places?
Science takes the path of least resistance, always. So any microorganism with those applications will be a common one.
Going to be common. See, now, I think that's not true with plants, for instance. You take digitalis, it's found in digitalis, and it's extremely useful in medicine, but it's not found in most plants. The way I understand this is that a lot of plants put out queer stuff to avoid predators. They don't have horns, and they can't run away, and so they have to make toxins, especially to prevent being grazed. And the toxins routinely do funny things to biochemicals, usually selected to do damaging things to the biochemistry of whatever eats it. But it turns out that those queer toxins often have medically funny, adaptable effects. And that's what I think happened to digitalis. That's one account of it. So then it's often true that the funny stuff is in strange plants when you're looking for medicine. But you're saying that probably not true. Microbes, at least if it's true, science takes a pass of least resistance. So the microbes that we now use are common. Microbes that we want to use for industrial, medical, agricultural probably commonness.
You have to be able to abuse them.
So, well, it's often true that a lot of stuff like lady slippers, which is rare, is tough to grow, and therefore it's hard to grow. So the microbes that rare and dangerous might be especially hard to get into the future. Mm-hmm. And the main thing. Yeah. Now then that might wipe out all these kinds of arguments on grounds that any microbe that would have industrial, agricultural, medical use is probably just a common, not likely to be endangered. And the endangered stuff is probably, if there is any, they're probably not going to be useful.
That's true.
So we can scratch that. Those arguments, that whole set of arguments, which is the biggest set of arguments used at the big scale level. The biggest set of arguments, that's not all that you said.
How about the vaccination
microbes? Now you may be saying that the microbes that might be useful for developing things to vaccinate with, they might be unusual.
They're probably more endangered than the others.
The ones that would be useful for patients, future vaccines.
Yeah, because you're developing resistant reservoir hosts, which are nothing more than culture chambers, and this is going to cut down quantitatively on the number of organisms that are in various habitats. Well, look at smallpox, for example. How did you control smallpox? By vaccination. And by vaccination, you reduce the number of reservoir hosts and therefore the number of viruses. And so the organisms for which vaccines have been developed are probably more endangered than the others.
As a result of the vaccine being
right.
used?
As a result of reducing the number of reservoir hosts.
Now, although interesting, these are economic rationales, and as I said, they are far and away the most widely used ones. Next point. They do not occur at all. These regions do not occur at all in endangered species act. it deliberately, it seems as though it deliberately avoids mention of these regions, which have indeed been widely used. And the biggest fuss nowadays, often, is that the Endangered Species Act, as it's now worded, doesn't even allow consideration of economic effects. Except you can appeal to the so-called God Committee when they set up this high-level committee to adjudicate economic trade-offs. And that committee has functioned a few times. So there is a kind of a high-level path to have economic effects considered. Now, what reasons then does the present existing Endangered Species Act give if it doesn't give those kind of reasons? Okay, here's the list. It says that these endangered species we want to save have aesthetic, ecological, educational, historical, recreational, and scientific values. And that's the reason why you ought, as it says, to temper economic development with an adequate consideration of these kinds of values. And so what I'd like to do is take a few minutes to kind of go through this list and see whether it's going to work. Let's eliminate what we can first. I don't think that microbes have any recreational value.
Here's the warning.
Booze.
Maybe. The microbes can be used to develop scintillating feelings might have a recreational value. But for the most part, we don't entertain ourselves using microbes.
Because somebody enjoys their work and they work with microbes. Well, that's recreational.
It's true if they are amateurs who recreate by watching and studying microbes. You know, I do that with mosses. Mosses have a recreational value for me. I spent Saturday night keying mosses. But and practically nobody else in the world does that. There might be such cases. But for the most part, not. Now, aesthetic value.
No.
Aren't diatoms microbes? They get mixed in with my moss slides when I put them in preservatives and so forth, and there are all these diatoms in there. And I'm trying to figure out what the cell structure is in the leaf of this moss, and it's got all these diatoms. They look kind of pretty. But on the other hand, if you're thinking of scenery, or if you're thinking of sort of watching a hawk fly through the sky and enjoying the flight and whatever, there doesn't seem to be a lot of aesthetic possibilities with preserving microbes for aesthetic reasons.
Unless that animal needs a microbe to survive.
Unless it contributes to other things that have aesthetic value, possible.
Well, in that case, why it's yes. Because without microbes, higher life wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, well now let's come to the ecological sort of question, which is maybe important to that. And microbes are in all of our ecology. There's zillions of more microbes in this room than there are people right now. So the microbes are essential in the life support system.
Right.
So they do have ecological value?
Yes.
They break
sucked up down and they're down at the bottom of the food chain? Do they have more or less ecological value than vertebrates?
More, more.
Okay, see, maybe, now it's often said by some that it's really the little stuff that runs the world. And the big stuff, like the grizzly bears, you could pretty much eliminate them, and there wouldn't be all that much change. Take out the microbes, the place would collapse. Now, that might be true of the function of microbes in general, but it might also be true that whatever ones that were rare, they weren't important ecologically.
Important
to local ecology in this lake or in the Dead Sea or whatever. So it may be that even the rare microbes might be locally important in the ecology.
Sure.
Okay. So this is perhaps a good reason for saying that. Historical value. Do they have any historical value?
Absolutely.
How so?
In what context?
Well, let's work this out.
The Panama Canal has that.
Now, you occasionally want to preserve things, big things, because they are historical mementos or souvenirs. If we had any passenger pigeons, we would like to save them. We don't have any, we lost them. We do have bison. We don't have many, but the bison had historical, attached to historical memories in the United States. And, Buffalo Bill, whatever. So it's kind of nice to have some bison kept around for historical reasons.
Well, it's
now, but I don't know whether that argument's going to work at all at the level of microbes. Maybe you would say because of Black Death, or because of historic adventures. You know, I read a book when I was a kid called Micro Hunters. Which was a story of celebrated famous scientists who investigated the past two years. You might say, well, for those kind of reasons, we'd like to have around to see some of these microbes that they worked with, like we'd like to have some bison that Buffalo Bill shot.
Would pictures do as well? I mean,
just like a picture of would a picture of a bison do as well?
You have collections throughout the world that are that include recognized species of microorganisms. You have one in this country in
I have to be pretty ignorant here. These are collections of dead microbes.
No, these are alive microbes. These are culture collections. The American type culture collection.
Got it. These are living microbes.
Right.
Now, we could
recognize species.
We could put, now it's often thought here though that it's important to keep these things in their ecosystem. So it won't do just to have grizzly bears in zoos. We'd like to have some in the wild in Yellowstone. One reason it's thought to be that people enjoy them more in the wild. They like to think there's some in the wild. But also it's said that grizzly bears in zoos won't be grizzly bears very long. After 200 years in zoos, they'll be genetically inferior to grizzly bears because they've not had to cope with the forces of natural selection. If there are microbes that we want to preserve, and we want to preserve them with this sort of rationale, can they be adequately preserved in test tubes or in these collections? And they don't have to be left in the wild. or do the ones that are in the Dead Sea or in the salt today, the salt have to stay in the wild to be what they are 200 years from now?
To continue to evolve.
Yeah.
In the way that they evolve.
Yeah. They'll change.
So you know, I have the same problems keeping microbes in zoos that you do keeping tigers in zoos. Pretty much the same stuff. They need to be kept sort of in their ecology if they are. Let me point out a few cases of where I think present conservation policies in some sense have, for one reason or another, protected microbes, or protected the natural selection and evolution of microbes. One of these was an interesting case in Yellowstone where the bighorn sheep got pink eye, it involves a microbe, if I have the name right, chlamydia. And the veterinarians and others, if you have pink eye as a kid, it's not too hard. You just find in bed, mom gives you a bowl of soup, and then after 2 or 3 days, you get eye drops and you're out and gone. But if you could catch pink eye when you're a bighorn sheep, you get partially blinded, and you miss a jump, or you can't see to eat. Right? And the result is that you starve. You get weakened condition, you get injured, you starve, and it takes about 6 weeks to starve. So they had all these injured and starving sheep in the bighorns because they had pink eye. And a number of people came in and said, by golly, let's fix it. Took this in veterinarians in Wyoming, that we can treat it and cure these sheep. But the park authorities, the philosophy up there is kind of let nature take its course. We don't intervene with the diseases of wildlife and wildlife. So they let the epidemic, to the consternation of many who love the sheep, run its course. And over half the bighorn herd in Yellowstone was perished over the period of 2 months. It's about 4 or 5 years ago. Now, that, of course, let the chlamydia microbe reach epidemic proportion. So that was a good thing for the chlamydia microbe. Even though the sheep suffered and died, so I'm not exactly sure that there's any Yellowstone Park policy to protect microbes, but in that case, they did not intervene in the interest of welfare of the sheep and let the microbe exist in the wild. Now, they did believe that it was natural, not caught from domestic sheep. I think if they had believed that this disease had been introduced from domestic sheep, probably would have intervened. But now I guess what I'm saying is the idea that nature sort of take its course up there where it involves animal diseases has often left microbes to run what ravages they may on animal populations. Okay, I haven't finished our list. Educational value. Do microbes have educational value?
No.
See, here I think the idea is that, well, you've got these school kids, and the school kids can go out in the woods and see chipmunks, and they can see orchids in the wild. You can use them to teach about appreciation of natural resources, etc. So you need to have some wild places with their fully intact fauna and flora in order to educate the kids, but also others, adults, who go out and enjoy the wild things, and they learn natural history. They learn important things, but we're not likely to use microbes.
We are likely to
have the fourth graders in to
put some farm butter in your microbes.
Oh, yeah.
And endangered ones too will, if there are any endangered ones, they can be put under the microscope and used for education. So this might be a relevant category. Scientific value. Do they have scientific value?
Medical, industrial, and whatever.
Only in the interest of applied science? Come on, folks, that's why I thought you'd jump on me. You got any doubt?
There's lots of opportunity there for both original research.
Just studying the basics of life?
Yes.
Teaching your life.
See, I have a feeling that, but I'm here to be said wrong. I have a feeling that we're more ignorant about the natural history of microbes than we are ignorant about the natural history of most anything else.
No.
No?
That's
not right?
That's not right.
Yeah. We have a way of saying that all the bird species are pretty well described. It's unusual for there to appear a new description of a bird species. But on the other hand, insects, we get new descriptions of insects all the time. Now, how about the microbes? Are the species of microbes 99% known?
That's hard to say, because you don't know what 100% is. But there are very, very few new species being discovered.
Because nobody's looking? Or
that's right, thinking. That's right. It's not the bandwagon.
I think there's probably, my feeling would be there's probably quite a few.
Like insects?
Because they're not
looking.
Not looking. I think that may also impact the original list of industrial agriculture, etc. Because I don't feel that we're looking for that.
But right now the emphasis is on the metabolism, the molecular biology of microorganisms. So we probably know more about their metabolic potentiality, their genetic potentiality, than we do about the other ones.
Another thing is that we tend to dwell on the organisms that cause disease and know more about those because they impact us more directly than the organisms that don't. And 99.09% of the organisms don't cause disease. So those we probably know very little about, I think.
So there might be a lot of natural history microbes out there that we just don't know about. Because we're not looking. Now, I have seen it said, this kind of thing, that if we are ever to learn about the origin of life, the chemical origin of life, long ago in the primeval supernova, that there are likely to be some clues to this in present existing microbes. For example, the way this came out was in the claim that it's in some of the hot springs in Yellowstone, where they have anaerobic bacteria that don't need any oxygen. And they live at extremely high temperature. And now the argument is, well, that's the way it was back in ancient times. There was no oxygen in the atmosphere, and the earth was very hot. And the kinds of processes that we will now find in the bacteria, anaerobic bacteria in hot springs, maybe there'll be clues to the origin of life there. And if we lose those habitats and those microbes in this concept we never know. Does that sound like a halfway reasonable argument? I hope you don't. Furthermore, isn't it the case that the genetic setup in microbes is rather different often than the genetic setup in big animals? Therefore, if you're going to uncover if you can figure out how to uncover the molecular history or the natural history, you'll need to do studies at that level. I don't know. I might be guessing, but I have an opinion that there probably a lot to be learned about the study of microbes that may give us clues to the natural history of life on this planet. Okay, well, I mentioned smallpox again, because that may be the only case of a kind of known extinction. It is deliberately caused. First question is smallpox extinct?
No.
There are cases recently reported?
No,
we still have the virus. We still have the virus. In these museums?
In museums.
They come in the wild.
It's extinct in the wild.
Right. It has potential to be a tremendous biological weapon.
It's believed to have been extinct in the wild for about 10 years, but it presently exists in culture.
And as far as we know, these cultures are still here.
How many cultures? A dozen? 300?
Who knows?
Now, I've been said that the reasons for keeping some smallpox are that it has potential being a tremendous biological weapon. Therefore, we don't have some of it. We know how to make whatever defenses we need to tell us to give it away. Does that sound right? Is that the only reason for keeping smallpox? Where we keep it, and that we want to be able to protect ourselves against terrorist use.
We can debate about whether the speaking genetics of it's probably also it might be
some have some genetic use. Finally, I want to ask you sort of a general question about respect for life. It's been said for many, by many, myself too, that there is such a thing as an ethical duty to respect life, and therefore I think that to save many of these living things, not simply because they have scenic value or they have recreational value or whatever, but there's some kind of intrinsic respect for life involved when you're saving, especially saving at the species level. Something kind of sad, something kind of wrong about the wolf, a bash, something. It has a kind of, this is I think not the ideal we get it, but it has a kind of right, if you like, to exist. Not necessarily individuals, but when the species goes extinct, you kind of feel that humans ought not without some overriding cause. Cause the extinction of species. We worry again about the snail virus. Now, it might be said that, well, that doesn't apply to microbes. Microbes are too small, too invisible, not very much alive, or whatever. I'm not sure about that. I wanted to sort of ask the question of, well, whether respect for life in that sense transfers down to the microbial level. I can imagine a couple of kind of answers. A couple of kind of answers might be, well, they have some minute amount of life that should be affected, but that's too trivial to ever make a difference in human decisions. So that they kind of theoretically might respect the life of those living things have value, and just because we happen to be and can't see them. We happen to live above water and we can't see all the stuff at the bottom of the sea. It's down there, we can know that. So it's time to close, and I just want to raise a kind of theoretical question to leave you for the difference. Whether it's possible that microbes, if we're going to respect life, all of them. In some sense, microbes too. Let me point out that in the history of life on Earth, I think about 3/4 of Earth's history, the history of life on Earth, occupied sold by an organism at the one cell level over evolutionary. So that the multi-celled organism will become the last part of the story. Then, even now, it seems to me that although humans report vision as organisms, the vastest number of living organisms today, including the kind of head count, are microbes. It's a little bit hard for me to see how full scale the spectrum of life, not in some sense, going to have some kind of account of place for recognition. Okay, thank you for your attention.